Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Mike DeZenon recording from Mamamoo Studio. Big thanks again to Eleni Andoniou for hosting us. And with me, I have Nafsika Hadjikristu.
Hello.
To those of Nafsika is a documentary maker and a seasoned long-term traveler. But to those of you that know me well, you know that my biggest pleasure, joy, inspiration, and general awesomeness is when I speak to younger, especially women. And Nafsika is one of those young women. Totally awesome, but I'm going to let her tell you about her awesomeness on her own. Nafsika, I've said given you a good introduction. Tell me, who is Nafsika?
I don't like to talk about myself like this.
Well, I'm afraid this is a podcast. Okay. You're going to have to talk about yourself. And can I tell you something? This is something that is often ingrained into women, that you don't talk about yourself. It's considered... But why shouldn't you promote yourself? And it's not promoting, it's telling things you've done, things you're proud of. Tell me about your traveling, because when the thing that really got me when I first met you is that fact that you spent 2 years traveling through South America. Mm-hmm. And traveling through with a backpack and a tent or whatever, but it wasn't one of those paid for gap years where you've got all the money. It was going from city to city, town to town, with a backpack, finding your space along the way. Tell me how you made that decision and how that turned out for you.
I always wanted to travel, and I was very fortunate to grow up in a family that prioritized travel, and I learned how to travel cheaply and finding opportunities to travel. And so when I finished university in 2020, I studied cinema in the UK. I just knew I wanted to go to South America, in Latin America, and I knew that from a long time before. I never questioned it. Like, I knew I wanted to travel, but especially Latin America. And then COVID happened, so I couldn't go anywhere. But it was fortunate in the end for me, because I managed to work a lot and save up, because, I mean, I didn't have anything else to do, and I didn't spend any money for that time it was COVID.
That 2 year period.
Yeah. So I saved up, and then I just booked a one-way ticket to Cuba, and yeah.
I remember your mother at the time. She was worried, but unaware of the fact that South America is a really not safe place to be a woman. She would have been more concerned, but looking back, she had no reason to be concerned, because you're quite you know your oats. You know how to protect yourself 360 degrees. Okay, so you land in Cuba and you're traveling on your own?
Yeah, always. I also knew that I wanted to do it alone. Mm-hmm. I didn't do too much research beforehand. I just researched what I shouldn't do, like how to keep myself safe, but that's about it.
Well, that's a good way to start, because, I mean, South America is not safe for women. And regardless of whether it's South America or not, everywhere you need to be safe when you don't know the environment that you're in.
Yeah, by the way, it's not South America, it's Latin America, because, for example, Mexico, that I spent a lot of time in, it's North America, actually.
You're right. Apologies.
Yeah, but I also went to South America. Yeah.
How was your Spanish before you traveled?
I was doing classes with an Argentinian teacher, a friend, but I couldn't speak. Like, I really couldn't say anything. So I just started speaking. When I was in Cuba, I had no choice, so I started speaking. Actually, the best thing I did that really forced me to open up and start, like, really speaking Spanish and understanding was on my second week in Cuba. I found some people who knew some people who were up in the mountains in this documentary institute that was there for 30 years. It's called Televisión Serana. And they welcomed me, and I went, like, alone in the mountains. There was no other foreigners, no one who spoke English. And there I was helping in the productions, and I had no choice. I had to speak Spanish and understand everything.
So, and you did.
I did. Yeah.
Tell me, the fact that you obviously helped by the fact that you like photography and you like documentary making, because this is, you're seeing new things around you. How easy was it to get work?
While traveling.
Yes. Because you need to support yourself, I'm assuming.
Yes, only the way I did it was saving up all the money I could save up. Like, it was all my own money that I worked to save up. But also working, like traveling with very little money. So I would often volunteer, I would do hitchhiking, stay in people's houses. So I actually didn't spend that much money. And volunteering, okay, I didn't work to make money in very few occasions. It's possible, but it actually doesn't make sense. Like, for example, in a hostel, they would pay you €1 an hour, which is a bit ridiculous. Like, it would be cheaper for me to do other things. Like,
We're not saying you needed to work. You need to finance traveling. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, if I remember correctly, the most expensive part of this traveling was the air tickets.
Yeah, always.
Always.
But if it's a one-way ticket and you will stay for a while, which is what I did, it makes a lot more sense. Like, you just paid once and then you find the cheapest way to go about it.
And how much would it cost you per day? I mean, is food cheap? Or yeah. Does it depend on which place you are in Latin America?
Of course it depends, but I would say I usually try to not go over €10 a day.
Wow.
But sometimes, like, my limit, absolute limit, was 25. Yeah.
Okay. And if I also remember from that conversation, that talk you had, one of the most expensive things is water.
Not for Europeans, but it's, in some places it's quite expensive. And especially because Coca-Cola, for example, in some states in Mexico, it's cheaper. That's why a lot of locals end up drinking more Coca-Cola than water.
And end up having diabetes.
Yeah, yeah. It's a huge problem, actually. I think Mexico is like the second most obese country. There's a lot of diabetes. A lot of people I know have family members who died from diabetes.
I used to be addicted to Coca-Cola. I used to have one or two every day, the big ones, and not light and whatever. And I had a heart attack, and they saw that I was borderline diabetic.
Wow.
And the same day, I stopped Coca-Cola, and my sugar levels are now back to almost normal. But it made me realize that something is like Coca. I actually brought it upon myself.
Yeah, you had to have that scare to stop.
Yes,
yeah.
To actually realize what it does to you. But back to you, traveling, I think volunteering is better anyway, because when you volunteer and you get involved, you actually learn the people more and the culture more. How much photography and documentary video taking did you do along the way?
Actually, that's a big thing, because when I was thinking about traveling, I was actually thinking of traveling without a camera and without a phone. Because
I was just about to say, oh, you're crazy, but I'm not going to say it.
In the end, I did travel with both, but basically why I was thinking that is because in my everyday life, my whole life basically, I've been taking too many photos every day, and I wanted to see what I can do without it, but not only concerning me, I just felt that it's quite wrong to show up in a foreign country, especially with a lot of like vulnerable populations, and just have your camera on you all the time and try and capture the best. Yeah. So I actually took a really old camera with me. I didn't take like my good camera, and I had an old phone as well. And I just used it, like, obviously it's really important to have a phone while traveling, but it's possible to not as well.
Get back to that. And you traveled and you would take photographs, you'd be more selective about taking photographs. You would be more selective about when you took photos. The one reason I agree with you about the camera is that a lot of the time we take photographs and we don't enjoy the moment. We are not present.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually just looking at what picture you're going to take, and you're not listening to sounds or smells or colors or different people. So sometimes you lose the...
Yeah, usually...
You lose the experience.
Usually what I did was spend at least 1 week somewhere before I took out my camera, which is strange for me, because in the past I would always... Like, I had done a lot of traveling before I went for my big trip, but I would always have my camera on me.
And well, when I think of you, I think of you with a camera in your hand.
Everyone. But yeah, no, traveling I didn't. Not only for like safety reasons, which of course you have to think about, but it's not the biggest thing.
What if someone's stealing your camera?
Yeah. Or like attacking you to steal it, because it's not a place that would they would just steal it. It's often they come with guns or yeah. But yeah,
it was. So why did you wait 1 week?
Well, I waited as long, like the amount of time that I felt was right to take out my camera. So when I knew people, when I knew the place better, when I knew my way around, and I didn't feel it was so invasive.
When you felt that people knew who you were, so you weren't exactly just a stranger dropping in with a parachute.
By the time that people ask photos, so like I would meet a family, I would spend time with them, and then I would say, oh, by the way, do you want photos of your family? And they would be like, yes, of course, we're so happy. But it's very different to not know someone and just take your camera out and point it at them. Like,
how did you feel? I mean, this is a real flip over for you. How did you feel about actually looking at things and not looking through your eyes and not through a lens?
Well, for sure, I was a lot more present. Photography and filming also, it doesn't make me less present. It just puts me in a different mindset.
Yes.
In a flow, like my own flow. But I didn't go traveling to just have my own flow. I just wanted to have the
immersion. You wanted to be immersed in the
like
community.
For it to be transparent, my experiences and the barriers that I had between me and like the other people around. So I wanted it to be as transparent as possible. And of course, when you have a camera, that breaks a bit that transparency. So
yes, it does, because you're behind the camera. And to me, it's also a power play. Because you, in a... Anyway, I'll go back to your photography, but the traveling to me is fascinating, because it's 2 years on the road that you met someone along the road. Your brother also joined you at some stage. But in most cases, you were alone.
Yeah.
How easy was it? Although the people that know you probably think it was quite easy, because you're quite a bold, confident young woman and you know where you're going, which is great. I mean, I wish we were all like that. How easy was it to be? How safe did you feel? Or rather, let's turn it around. Were there times that you actually felt unsafe or threatened?
I didn't feel unsafe many times, almost none. I would say it was really easy, because it's what I wanted to do. For sure, if you are alone and you don't want to be alone, that's not nice. But I had a lot of the times I met people I could continue travel with. Like, I would travel for a bit and then we could continue. And then I would decide, no, I want to be alone. Because for especially the first year, I had made the decision that I want to be alone for the whole year. So, I mean, of course, I made a lot of friends and we did things together, but I would always end up being alone because I wanted to.
It was a choice.
And I loved it. It's amazing, because from the first moment I realized there's more than one person inside. Like, I would have conversations with myself, like, do we want to follow this person? Do we trust them? Like, is it something we want to do? And we would make decisions like many rational people.
And when you talk about we would make a decision and you're talking about...
And it
you.
Sounds funny. but yeah, it was amazing to discover all these different voices and have inner conversations. Like, it made all these voices stronger. Like, not like as a crazy person.
No. You were much clearer about who you were. It cleared up certain... this is 2 years of traveling, making friends, being alone, being with your brother, finding a partner. I want you to tell me two or three experiences that stood out. You've already told me one before we started this conversation. Two or three days that actually just popped up and you think, wow, that really changed my life.
I would say...
The one is the 8th of March in Mexico.
The 8th of March in Mexico, and in general, all the protests I've attended. But the 8th of March particularly, it was insane to be among all these women marching.
8th of March in Mexico City. Yeah. That Mexico City has one of the highest percentages of
femicide, yeah.
It's not a particularly safe place to be a woman, but
and so many disappeared women every day. Like, I think there's something like 11 women that disappear every day.
I interviewed a lovely Mexican woman, but she was so unconfident about her English that the interview turned out to be not doable, because she kept on. Anyway, and she said to me, "There's 7 femicides a day every year. 7 go to court and one gets... Their numbers are insane of how many people, how many of these women are actually found and how many of the perpetrators, which is usually men and possibly men from the family, actually made accountable. So it's a terrifying...
And it's very difficult to find justice in this system. Like, that's why the 8th of March is so important. And huge, also the 25th of November coming up, because it's a day against violence. Yeah.
So tell me about the 8th of March, because you said to me, I've got to, if I'm going to Mexico, I've got to be in Mexico City on the 8th of March.
Yeah.
Tell me.
It's quite scary, actually, because the police changes the whole city. Like, they do it for most demonstrations, but I think for the March of the 8th of March, is they really change the whole city. They put barriers between every street, every shop. They try to narrow the way that anyone can go through.
So they actually control the movement of the protesters.
But not only the movement, because they know women literally burn the city down and they destroy everything they see on their way, which, okay, is quite extreme. Mm-hmm. But of course, you can imagine their anger is very different from what we experience here in Europe. So it's not something I can judge. So they just literally put these physical big metal barriers that change the whole city. Like, you cannot really see any buildings, monuments. A lot of roads are closed, and that starts a long time before. And so a lot of women spend their days while the police is putting up these barriers to actually paint these barriers. And they make them like an open arts museum.
Okay, so like, what do you call it, graffiti. They paint graffiti along the way.
And they stick posters, they stickers. They just make a huge, like, it's insane. And that stays for a long time after the march as well. And then during the march, it changes, like it's constantly shifting. So you see the city in many different ways, perspectives. And then when the day actually comes, there are many different blocks. Like, there must be, I don't know, maybe thousands of different blocks. Like, I don't know, women for Palestine, queer women for Palestine, trans women for Palestine.
There's also women, mothers of the missing.
Yeah, and many different blogs, groups. Yeah,
that must have been an absolute pleasure to be there for you as a photographer. The pictures you could... Did you take pictures
I
or
did.
Not?
There, yes, I did. And I was with... And yeah, I took a lot of pictures. And but there are a lot of Mexican photographers that I would follow from before, like feminist photographers that... Like, it's a huge day for them. And I always felt like it was wrong for me to be documenting that, when for them it's like something they prepare for the whole year and then they document it. But really, it was amazing to document it as well.
No, but I think I think there's, you can support and promote and share what they're doing. But to also be documented from a third eye,
it's different.
Which is different.
Yeah.
Tell me, how aware, how socially active were you before you went on this trip? So how much social consciousness do you have? I mean, are you a feminist?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, of course. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
How, I know you, your family's quite verbal. They aren't conservative in that. So you were encouraged to be who you are, who you wanted to be.
Yes, I was always involved with activism and like different kinds, like, okay, of course, feminism and climate change and migrant rights and racism and human rights. And especially because I was in Cyprus during COVID, where there was a big movement happening. I was really involved. And I think that made me even more politicized and radicalized in a way. But especially my trip in Latin America, that made me way more, because I saw a lot of injustices. And actually, I was really involved with different... movements and protests. Like, when you ask me what my favorite, like the most important things I did, I think one of the most important, I would say, was being, okay, I did a lot of human rights observing, but also I was part...
I think you also did that as work, the human rights observing.
It was volunteering, yeah.
Yes, yeah. That ramps up.
Mm-hmm. But I was trained and, But yeah, Mexico is actually one of the most dangerous places on earth to be a human rights defender. A lot of people that die must disappear. So, and also foreigners, but mainly Mexicans.
Sorry to interrupt, but the young woman I interviewed was a human rights lawyer, and she used to say, when it's an important case or a controversial case, I'm actually not sure that I'm going to step out of my house and come back in, or leave the courthouse and leave and live through. So to me,
lawyers are also
so attacked. To me, that doesn't live this. No. It's quite horrifying to hear that this actually happens.
Yeah, no, I've heard so many stories, because I was also really involved. And when we were there doing human rights observing, we were told to not talk about it, to not show anything in our clothes, in our bags, do not have anything that shows that we do this, because it can put our life in danger. Like, there was a lot of training on how to put ourselves safe and not in the spotlight. But also I was part of this caravan, which was about a two-week protest in the south of Mexico. We were like three big buses and then a lot of cars that were following. It was a huge protest of like organization of indigenous people and the National Indigenous Congress against the mega project that the previous government was doing, AMLO government. Mm.
And what was the project? Did it have to do with using land badly?
Basically, the two biggest projects that we were protesting against, one was the Tren Maya, the Maya train that is in the south of Mexico, mainly in Quintana Roo to Chiapas, and it's a very heavily populated indigenous population with a lot of important sites, and it's very ironic that they called it the Maya train, because there's nothing about it that is Maya. It's actually destroying Maya land.
Okay.
And it's passing through, it literally cut one of the most important jungles in the world in half. Mm. That's where jaguars live. There's a lot of important biodiversity that is nowhere else found. And they, like, cutting the jungle in half means killing everyone on the way. And then they're going to build huge restaurants and hotels and resorts. And they built, actually, it was really badly planned, and a lot of parts of the plane collapsed because they were on top of cenotes, which are these basically underground rivers, like sacred water for the Mayas. And they are like big pools, basically, of water that are really important. And they are only source of water in many communities. And they built the train on top, and then it collapsed. Like, while building it, like, they had a lot of issues, because that's not a place to build a train. and it's, they say that it's a touristic project, but in fact, it's in a very strategic position, because it's very near the border with Guatemala, which that border is one of the most important borders, because it's where all the immigrants from South and Central America pass to go to the USA.
Okay, and it's so also a transition border.
Yeah, and it's also the Narcos route.
Okay.
So it's a very, and also some of the most rebellious indigenous populations live in that area. So it's a way to militarize the area.
Yes, to control them, to try and
exactly.
control them.
So, a lot of repression happening in that area. And there's actually another train from Oaxaca to Veracruz, which is further up south as well, which is a bit like the Panama Canal or the Suez Canal.
Which joins.
To join the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean for commercial reasons, but also destroying everything on its way.
So for the people building, it controls. And for the people that are living there, it destroys what exists there. Tell me another highlight. Tell me you've been to Mexico, Guatemala,
Cuba, Mexico, Guatemala, Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil, but only in the Amazon.
Tell me, you've discussed Mexico quite in detail of why it was also important.
That's where I spend.
I want to go to Colombia, and I don't know why. I've got a very good friend there that I've met through one of the regional networks that I belong to, and she works a lot with indigenous women. And I think the one thing that endeared me to her completely is that we went on I belong to a regional network called the Women's Alliance of Security Leadership, and it's first responders. It's women on the ground in NGOs in conflict areas. And we came together in the Maldives, of all places, but we came together there because this was the only place that would accept Palestinians, these people, Palestinians, Iraqis. They would give them a visa at the border. So anyway, and one of the women that was organizing had left America, stopped breastfeeding her baby because she had to travel, and almost developed mastitis. Mm. And my Colombian friend said, come to me. And every night she would use a method that the indigenous woman would use, which is warm towels, the massaging. And she said, it's under control, but go back to America. And when you go back to America, get it checked. And by the time she got back, it was cured. Mm. So to me, this thing that we've actually moved beyond, we consider what the indigenous women do as alternative, and we consider real a Western medicine the real
thing. The real medicine.
To me, it was very much it's something that will always stay with me. So I've always wanted to go and visit Emmy, my friend, Emilia yeah. Rosa in Colombia.
Actually, I had a really interesting experience in Colombia with real, like in question mark, real medicine and traditional medicine, because also it throughout Latin America is practice, and they have mm-hmm. their own practices and plant medicine, and there's so much to learn from all
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely, and it's things that don't hurt you, because I learned it from mm-hmm. my mother-in-law, who was old school, and she would give me things to do for when the baby wasn't well, and at the worst, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work, but it doesn't harm you.
Yes.
It doesn't harm you. It's not
it could, but yeah, most likely not.
And most likely not. When, yeah. I mean, the ones she was telling me about wouldn't hurt the baby.
Mm.
At the best, it helped. But at the worst, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, she taught me to put Uzo on his gums. yeah. Which, I mean, it's a, what you call alcohol. So yeah. Anyway, so this thing that we consider this alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me your experience with yeah. in Colombia.
I was in the Amazon. I think the place I would always want to go back to and love the most is the Amazon.
Mm,
it's
I'm
also
sure.
one of the most difficult places to be in because, I mean, conditions are difficult. Right? It's complicated to be there, but it's incredible.
Because it's also physical. I mean, you've got
yeah.
swamps, you've got water, you've got
mosquitoes.
You
know, all the wildlife, but it's incredible. I went, yeah, I
and
spent quite a
photograph.
Bit in the Amazon. Yeah.
incredible to photograph.
Yeah. So I spent quite a bit of time in the Amazon, and the first time I went and I was alone, I climbed this tree, 40 meters tree. I was fine, but afterwards I tried to climb another thing, and something like a muscle was strained or something, and I couldn't walk, like I fell and I couldn't do anything.
And you were in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah, and I was.
and were you alone?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
no, there were people around. I wasn't the only person there, of course, but you don't go to the jungle alone. Mm. I mean, you have to have guides. And
you practically also have to go with a group-ish because it's a jungle. You can get lost.
I went alone, but then I would find people to join me or to join them in like a little tour of like visiting a big tree or something.
Okay.
And then with a guide, with a local guide, because you don't enter the jungle alone. That's stupid.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's yes. stupid to enter. I mean, yeah. it's common sense. You don't enter alone.
But I was in the villages alone. I was going alone. I was, yeah.
It's the same as you don't climb the Mount Everest alone. Because
yeah.
you're going into places that things can happen. Shit
yeah.
can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you could break a bone. You can fall. And
yeah.
who's going to find you?
And there.
Or snakes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can
there's
get bitten.
So much. Mm. Like, local people die from things that they've known their whole life. So.
Mm.
Yeah, I think in these cases and in any jungle, you just really need to trust locals and no one else. Like, not even have a guide from the outside. You just have to have people who know the jungle. Yeah, because you can get lost so easily in the jungle. Like when I was in Tikal in Guatemala, which is this Biosfera and Maya is called, is this incredible jungle that has like a Mayan city. With full of pyramids. They don't even know how many there are in there.
Yes, I'm sure. It's
insane. That's one of my favorite places. People get lost every year because they go with a guide that is not a local and they get lost and they might die in the jungle.
Mm.
Like when we went, like 3 days before, this French family got lost in the jungle and they found them almost dead. Like 3 days later with no water, no food and yeah.
Tell me, because mm-hmm. I know in each community, Spanish is different, their mm-hmm. dialect. How did you navigate Spanish? Because you stepped into Cuba and you immediately started talking because you
yeah.
went, because you had to. But then the dialect changes. Was it easy to navigate the dialect?
I guess Cuba is the most difficult Spanish because they merge all the words together and it's quite, yeah, it's like the Cubans had to really adapt their speech so I could understand them.
Okay.
I think if I go now, it wouldn't be a problem, but then it was quite complicated at times. But no, I think Spanish, I mean, obviously it changes a lot, but I loved learning different words and phrases from each country. But I think what was more challenging, but I still loved it, it was the indigenous languages that were very different.
Yes, like, they're not related at all to...
Not at all. So, like, it might be the same language, but a village, two villages that are 10 minutes apart might speak a different dialect, and there you don't understand anything between them. So I learned a little bit of Tzotzil while I was in Chiapas, and it was really useful because especially women don't learn Spanish in their communities. So it's important to know a bit of...
The indigenous language.
Yeah, to do like a basic conversation is very important.
But now because we... If I come to you and tell you I want to do this trip and I'm 40 years younger, what are the two or three things you would tell someone who potentially wants to become a long-term traveler? What are the things you learned besides the fact that you don't travel alone into jungles?
I think you should know where not to go in order to keep safe. Like,
so you should do this guide of examine the things that I should not do.
Yeah, where not to go and what you shouldn't do. And then I personally don't research what I should do. Like where to go, like the most popular spots. I never research that. I just go and find out.
But I do the same thing wherever I travel. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in New York 3 months ago and I had brunch with a friend and then I just started exploring. I didn't know where I was.
Mm.
A lot of fun. I don't like to go there where all the tourists are, where I have to be.
Yeah.
Or where I should be. Or where the tourist guide says, this is you have to. No. I also like to explore. Yeah,
because I think one of the most important things about traveling, and especially because now there are too many people traveling, like it's damaging the planet as well. And I think there are many ways to do it, and there are some ways that are way more damaging than others. Like the commercial type of traveling that you just go and try and feed as much as you can in a few days and literally you're consuming, like you just jump from one place to the next, not really meeting anyone, but trying to pay for an authentic experience. Mm-hmm. It's damaging for the populations that live there, for especially if they're vulnerable groups. I think it's better to not go there at all. I know that a lot of people don't have another way to travel because they don't have time. But it's still, you really need to consider where you're going because it could make a lot of damage in the end.
A friend of mine just spent 2 weeks in the States, San Francisco, Las Vegas, San Diego. They were 2 weeks, four people in a car. She said to me, she came back and said to me, you know what, nightmare. Because firstly she said we found a hotel next to the airport, which means that when one of us was alone, nowhere to explore. And she said, we went from place to place, never breathing in the space, never knowing if there was a really good place to eat, but eating what was along the road. We actually didn't see anything. Because she said, we were constantly in this car going around because the person that organized it just wanted to see everything, but had no concept that rather choose three nice things and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And enjoy the experience because you come back and you're exhausted. Rather than do 30 things, then come back and say, what did I actually see? And I agree with you, the more you travel, the more you do too much cars.
Money, gas.
Yes, carbon footprints overloaded. So so you're saying that if I want to travel, the first thing I must do is...
Travel slow.
Yeah, no, travel slow, I totally agree. But also see what I shouldn't be doing, what I should be avoiding. Language?
Language, I mean... For me, it's so important to know at least a bit, but obviously it's not that easy. Like, there are some countries that it would be really difficult to learn.
You just went to India as well.
Yeah.
But in India, Indian?
I mean, India, every area has a different language, so it's very complicated. I think only if you decide to stay in one place for a really long time, you will learn the language there, but otherwise, even learning Hindi is not that useful because from one place to the next, even if they're close together, it would be hard to communicate. Because It's very different.
You've, as you said, you've been very fortunate to be born into a family that's encouraged traveling.
Yeah.
If you chose one place to go back to, I mean, which is the one place you would go back to? Because I watched, I saw the photographs of Kerala recently, and I thought, wow, this is where I want to go to because of the colors.
In India or in general?
In India. I saw that the Kerala are part of it. No. In general, which is a place you would want to go back to?
I actually want to go and always try to go back to the same places. Like when I was traveling for 2 years, I returned to almost every place I visited. So I love repeating destinations and repeating the same trip because I feel like it builds a lot to the depth of knowing that place. So obviously the Amazon, but also other parts, because I've been to the Colombian and Brazilian Amazon a lot, but I would like to explore. I mean, it expands across many countries.
I also know you're doing a master's degree now.
Not yet,
but you're planning to do one.
Visual anthropology. Yeah.
Which, considering you're a documentary maker and you carry your camera, it's almost an extension of your hand. How has this trip, I'm sure, contributed, but how much has it enriched who you are and what you're going to take forward into your study?
I think the most important thing I've been learning was who can tell which story, because obviously in our world, people are very excited by exotic things and exotic stories, but I don't think it's right for anyone white and privileged to go and film things in vulnerable communities just because they are exotic to them. Because there are so many incredible filmmakers and documentary makers in the places, from the places, that can tell their stories perfectly well, and they don't need someone else to do that.
But as I said earlier, sometimes the third eye brings another perspective. It's not, you're not speaking, it's the same thing I always say when I go to a forum and they want to know about Turkish Cypriot women. And I'll say, I can talk about a few things, but I cannot talk on behalf of them. I will give you what I see and what I hear, but I cannot. But that third eye is also sometimes important.
Of course, but there are ways to approach it. Because I've seen, like, so many people tell me, oh, I want to travel and do projects while I'm traveling. But I think if you haven't done it for a while and you just go starting to do something, like arriving and starting, then it can be very
challenging.
Yeah, because who are you? Why do you need to go there and do that? Like, I think that there is anyone has to spend a lot of time in that place to be able to say something about it.
And I agree with you. I can't step into Bogota and 2 weeks later do a documentary because what the hell do
who
I know
are
about
you?
The issue? Who am I? And where do I get the sense of entitlement that I can actually speak on behalf of locals? Or 2 weeks later, who am I?
Yeah.
No, so I agree with you.
I think one of the most important experiences I've had was while doing human rights observing, I was in this community / movement organization, indigenous autonomous movement, where they had, like, next to the house where we were the volunteers of human rights observing, there was the media house, and they were working on a documentary about their history. And I told them, I also make documentaries. I can help you if you need help with anything. And they gave me like a few tasks to do, and I was helping them every day, and I was in their meetings, I observed how they work, and it was incredible to see how they organize among themselves and how important it is that they tell their history.
Yes.
And that, like, I mean, they were telling me about other people that came, and they were like, okay, we need people to interview, we're gonna do a documentary about you, which, okay, it's fine, but not so much if there are people already doing that.
You've got to be respectful of the people that are there that have the lived experience.
Yeah, and also the way they were doing it, like, I learned so much from them, was they, instead of having a hierarchy, like we are very used to in the West, they didn't have that.
It was more horizontal.
Yeah, like, you know how auteur cinema exists and it's so popular in the West, like, wow, there's this incredible director and the director does everything and it's like their signature film. that's a bit bullshit, to be honest, because so many people work to make a film. And they know that. And they have their own filmmaking processes that are very communal.
So it's more horizontal. It's
because
a community
their way of existing is communal and horizontal anyway. So, of course, it will be translated into everything they do. So it was really incredible to see their ways of working and also the spirituality in it. The way that they did ceremonies to be able to bond and work in the right way. It had so many different elements that you would never think about in this part of the world. Yeah.
If you just stepped in and thought, this is where I want to tell my story. Tell me, going forward, where do you see your career as a documentary maker? Because I know it's very much part of who you are. Mm-hmm. Where do you think this will take you? Or don't you know yet because you're still on the journey and you're exploring?
I'm very much on the journey. But yeah, I feel like when I started traveling, I went in with so much of this questioning of what is the right way to do things and if there is a right way or more just way. And because I studied in the UK, and any UK university or just being in the UK feels like you're in the center of the world because that's how they present it, which I find quite disgusting.
I agree.
And
welcome to colonialism.
Yeah, exactly. And very commercial. Like my university, it was really good. We learned everything essential, but it was very industrial, very commercial. And I just really wanted to reject all of these ideas of
special ways and structures to do things.
Mm-hmm. So I think that was a really important part of this journey and why I wanted to travel for so long, like to decolonize my thought a bit. And I'm still searching, but I feel like slowly I'm finding other ways to do things, which are probably not in Europe.
You know, the way I see life now, I think Europe is going to, there's going to be a lot of change coming around.
There is change.
There is change. I think we've all realized this EU concept doesn't actually work because it's patriarchy.
EU and safety and security doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. It's just another way of giving some civil servants jobs and apparent say of a communal policy. So I think especially with the Trump era coming in, and I think there's going to be a big shake.
The rise of the far right everywhere. So everyone says, but don't you feel unsafe traveling in Latin America and in Mexico? Like everyone has this image that is really unsafe. But actually, I feel Europe is becoming a lot more unsafe in many ways.
Well, your mother the other day was telling us about what happened to your brother in Amsterdam. But I agree with you.
My brother is safer in the jungle where he will go soon to do his master's practice than in Amsterdam.
No, but I agree. I think we have this illusion that this is safe. I grew up in apartheid South Africa, so we were taught, I mean, it's within me of how to keep myself safe.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, you often don't feel that safety because it actually is unexpected. Yeah. You're not expecting the police to suddenly arrest you or drop you off in a field and then run after you and beat you up. So I think there is a big shift of what is safe and what is unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, that's why there's got to be a big focus on how do I keep myself safe? Yeah. And not within the context of Cyprus or the States. How do I actually protect myself? And there are certain things you can do. You've got to learn to have circular vision, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go in with confidence, but with respect.
Yeah. But I think the most important thing is to build communities that we keep each other safe.
And the community is not necessarily the people physically around you. It's
the state will never keep us safe.
No, the state won't keep you safe.
The police won't keep us safe. So,
and the community is a big word because it's not necessarily the community, your community in Nicosia. It's your global community.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. And I find that's what helped me. I mean, the Mediterranean Women Mediators Network, the Commonwealth Mediators Network, the Women's Alliance of Security Leadership. And I find that I often find solace or a good sounding board, not necessarily within my Cyprus community, but within the conversations we have online or when we meet. So I think you're right. The biggest thing is to build your community with trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
To build your community with trust. Because I'll go to Mexico and I'll know who to reach out to.
Yeah.
And I'll have a community there that won't always keep me safe, mm-hmm. but can give me a few tips of how to keep myself safe, of things not to do.
That's why while traveling, I felt really safe within activist groups, because I know that they have this mentality of keeping each other safe, that, I don't know, looking out for each other. That's the whole point of activism. But yes. It's solidarity.
It's solidarity.
Yeah.
So, I agree with you. This thing of creating, whether it's a sisterhood, a brotherhood, a communityhood, mm-hmm. cannot be underestimated enough. It's really priceless.
Yeah.
It's really priceless. Mm-hmm. Because it's info. Firstly, it's a sister everywhere, a brother everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you never know when you need people, and you never know when people need you. It's a both-way relationship.
Yeah.
It's a both-way mm-hmm. relationship. So you're still on the journey. Tell me, and I'm really going to go far back, when did photographs become important to you?
I think ever since I was very little. Like, I always remember having a small camera. And, and I have a really huge archive, actually, of photos from since I was five that I was taking, like from my parents' camera. But then I got my first camera when I was like maybe 10, like a point and shoot, very small camera. And yeah, because I am hearing impaired, I think that's my way of understanding the world visually.
Okay.
So that I think sense. That's a huge thing, although I didn't know it back then.
But you did because you felt it.
Yeah, I felt it. But you felt obviously, it. Yeah, visually was all that made sense to me, mm-hmm. like to understand the world. And I think especially now, I mean, it's lucky that I live in a time that everything visual is so important and impactful, and it drives our societies in a bad way as well. But
yes, it's not always a good thing.
But I think there's also, like, it could be a bit like the poison, but also the medicine if we use it in the right way.
Well, I agree with you. It's the way we look at social media.
So that's why it excites me to work in this section, sector, of media.
Tell mm-hmm. me, because we're going to close this. Mm-hmm. If there's one project you've personally done, which is the one project you look at and you smile gently internally and externally? Although I know when you do projects like you do, they all like your children. They're all something that belonged. Is there anyone that has a particular special place in your heart?
My own project. I think photographing different people that have really changed my way of thinking while traveling, especially activists.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it wasn't a big project or something, but it was a very like...
important.
Yeah, because I was interviewing and photographing people that, that... their activism was their lives and they had no other choice but to do it. And I wanted to understand what it is that drives them and why that is the most crucial thing that they are doing. Yeah.
Okay. And you, so before we close, I want you to, what piece of advice would you give a young person that wants to travel?
To travel.
Or if they, is it the best thing you've ever done in your life?
For sure. And I will continue doing.
When's the next trip?
As soon as possible from the next year, like
where?
January. I'm thinking of going to Ethiopia in January, actually.
Oh, I went to Ethiopia last December.
Ah.
And I don't know why I'd always had this feeling. I have to go to Ethiopia. First, be prepared for the altitude.
Yeah.
Okay. I stepped off the airplane and because I'm asthmatic, I suddenly had palpitation. Mm. But it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's the rich and the poor. It's these women walking around in their white materials that is so ethereal, yet this life is so harsh. It's the fact that Ethiopia is the only country in Africa that was not colonized.
Yeah.
I think the Italians tried at one stage, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when we went then we thought, you know what, English, French, Italian, no, there's no common language.
Yeah.
It's also the place of the first female that stood on 2 feet, Lucy, that I saw. I'll show you the picture. So to me, it was absolutely fascinating. And they also have pyramids.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that.
Unfortunately, you can't travel a lot on the land because it's actually dangerous because
there's war now in the north. Yeah.
But the guide that took us, we were about six of us that arrived before the conference started, and we found a guide and we went around, and he said, for something like 250 euros, we could rent a small aeroplane to take us to the... no, but when there's six or seven of you, it doesn't work out that expensive to fly you to the place where the pyramids are to see them, because he says they're absolutely fascinating. Mm. But to me, when you go there and you see how everything started there.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, Cleopatra went, Nefertiti, was Nefertiti. Queen of Sheba, she went to Jerusalem. She had a baby with King Solomon, but it didn't work out. And she came back and she was a single parent and she was a queen. I mean, you find out fact, to me, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So go. I want to go again because I want to go to those pyramids. If you actually look it up in the Google it, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's a country with very little tourism. And I can understand why. And you're not a coffee drinker. Are you a coffee drinker?
Not so much, but I'm sure I'll try.
Or the Arabica coffee is originally Ethiopian.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could bring back for my son. And I thought, okay. And he said to me, Mom, the best coffee ever. But it's a wonderful city to a place to explore, because firstly, the people are so proud of their country. And secondly, it's an undiscovered treasure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The history, the world started there.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's a good place to start. I'll go to Mexico and maybe we can meet in Mexico when you get there.
Yeah, I'm going to Mexico after.
Okay. Any last thing you want to say before we...
I'm actually starting now a travel blog.
Okay.
And I'm going to be sharing more on this.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So I'll share it with you.
Good. I want to know, does lone traveling have an age?
No, not at all.
A friend of mine is, she's slightly younger than me, so she's about 62. She's had enough of living in this box of this thing of being, having a place to stay, a car to drive, owing money. And she's, because I was telling her about you, and you were telling about the fact that you don't need, the expense is going, but the living can be quite cheap. She says to me, I want to go. So do you think it's possible to start traveling?
For sure. I mean, on my first day in Mexico, the first friend I made was an 82-year-old woman that told me, she was a solo backpacker, and she told me, what, am I sit on my couch in Poland and wait to die and have back pain? I could just have back pain traveling.
Okay, that's a lovely message to the...
And it was really inspiring because I really felt like we were equals age-wise. Like, when you travel and you meet other travelers, age really doesn't matter. Unless they are like on spring break and they...
that's another thing.
Yeah, but...
No, but I agree with you. To me, age isn't necessarily important. It's an attitude. Mm-hmm. But the thing, when I thought about traveling alone, it's also there's a physical challenge. And the older you get, you do have physical challenges. Anyway,
Find the way to do it.
I'll introduce you to her and maybe you can help her find the way.
Yeah.
I will also expect you to send me the link to your blog because I think it's important.
It's going to be called Other Worlds.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm always happy to speak to you, Nafsika, because you always make me hopeful. And you know me, in my next life, I'm going to be a documentary maker, because to me, visual is so important. I don't know if it's become more important to me because I lost partial hearing in the one ear when I was younger, and I'm getting old and it's getting worse. So maybe that's why visual has also become to me, because I can sit and watch documentaries, pictures forever and get, it's like I'm there. So maybe I will do, it's never too late.
Yeah.
It's never too late. But just rock on, Nafsika. Travel safely. That's the most important thing. And enjoy. I mean, life is very small. Mm. And this thing that we've got to stay in one place and get a corporate job and get married and picket fence and have kids.
That's not the kind of life I
want. I'm saying it and I'm thinking to myself, no. God, no. So rock on, be adventurous, be safe, and keep us informed.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me as well.
Thank you. And to the listeners, as I said to Nafsika, stay safe and always rock on. Always believe in yourself. Thank you.
Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open. diverse, free.